Reading from the Red Bhagavad Tamrita, Volume 1, Chapter 5, Text 113. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Chitta Vakpati Naipunya. Yaridam nasvayoditam tarasambhavitam nasyat yaravendra prabhavata. You can defeat the wit of even Brahma, the master of speech. And so by the power of our Lord, Yaravendra, what you have said to us cannot be untrue. On one hand, the Yadavas listening to Narada are inclined to discount Narada's description of themselves as exaggerated flattery. Thus they call Narada the most expert word juggler. Expert word juggler. Vakpati, the master of speech. The most naipunya, expert master of speech. So this is in response to Narada's glorification of them, which does not sit well with the position and mood of a Vaishnava, one whose only object of worship is Krishna. And shies away from the position of worship when accepted out of egotism, moves one away from the position of devotion and spiritual life. Spiritual practice means to move to the position of devotion in all our practices, activities, culture are meant to put us in a position of servant. On the other hand, when Krishna is personally involved in anything, it's possible. They're his family members, and Narada is one of his eternal Vaikuntha associates. So they are forced to accept Narada's statements as true. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnanandana Salakaya Taksurum Vritam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vairagya Yud Bhakti Vishampi Yatnai Apayama Manadipsanandham Kupamburiya Paraduka Duki Sanatanastam Prabhamasriyami Pancha Kalpa Kalubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vaivusha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivakadi Ghor Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Greetings from the Sun Falls. I'm here for, actually I leave today. I have a very, very exciting program. I'm excited about it because it's so well organized at
place called Yogascape in Carmel, New York. And I'm giving two consecutive lectures. It's been actually quite a nice week for sharing the things that I've studied for so long. On Thursday, I came from Washington. Last week, and then on Wednesday night, I stayed with Professor Bryant, who is the author of the Commentary on the Yoga Sutras, which practically wherever I go, it's in the yoga world, it's on someone's desk. It's really that good. And stayed over at his house, and then he asked me to give his class the next day. And the Clay teaches a Hindu philosophy class, which is very successful. There's a couple hundred students in the class. So it's a big auditorium with a stage. And, I agreed to give the last half of the class because Jainism the fundamental teaching really is about eradicating karma. And I knew a little bit of something about what they said. What was so edifying is the response of the students really, really were absorbed, and they expressed their appreciation at the end. And my last point, of course, about karma, after I explained how it basically works, I explained that it's a science that really can be proved. And I linked it up with astrology, which gives a map of karma. And I said, if I had any five of your birth charts, I gave it to an astrologer who was good, then based on just that information about birth, he could tell so much about you. And it's basically scientific. I said if Bill Gates was in the audience and we gave 20 charts, including his, any astrologer would say, if you say who's the wealthiest man, they would, without knowing who he is, they would point to that person who's born on that day, because it would be so obvious. So it's a science, and it's really startling to people too, because you're talking when you talk theological concepts, there it's kind of makes sense, but it's a faith. But this is science, and it can be proven. It can be proven within the method of even modern science, right? But it's just such a far out thing. Probably people would be scorned a priori just because of prejudice. But so I said, I can prove it to you. I've done this in so many places. I said, okay. So the first five people that send me an email, I will get a chart done. Anyway, I got over 55 emails. But within the emails were students' comments, at least 10, 15 comments about the effect that this kind of knowledge had, how much they were listening deeply and thinking about these kind of concepts. And I'm in touch with actually many of the students who just expressed so much interest. That was kind of edifying how much this type of knowledge is needed and appreciated. Today I'll do two more seminars, which I've been working on. So, of course, we're on Narada Muni's wonderful journey, which indicates the nature of a devotee is his enthusiasm for Krishna and for those whom Krishna is in relationship with. Bhakti is enthusiasm. It's our attraction. The symptom of attraction is enthusiasm for the object of your attraction. So Narada is really enthusiastic to get good association, which is the fundamental principle of transformation. It's sangha, association with those who exemplify the values that you are trying to attain. We can't emphasize this enough, that on the bhakti path, it moves by the tracks of good association, which means more advanced, like-minded, same school, same mood in that school, and affection or relationship with that person to maximize the transference or emulation of the qualities that person has. Exemplars are just so important in the transformation of consciousness. Those of you that are parents, influence that your children will have and the path they take and the qualities they want to imbue are the examples of their parents. And I know in speaking to parents who have some taste of spiritual knowledge and have concern for their children, how having a child can be so inspiring for them spiritually as they make sacrifices to mold their lives, to create the best environment for their child and the best example for their child. Anyway, Narada is seeking this association, and he comes into the court of the Yadavas. Ugrasena is the king. Ugrasena was imprisoned by Kamsa when Krishna killed Kamsa. He enthroned Ugrasena. And when he enthroned Ugrasena, then Krishna also accepted him as the king, which was a bit of an awkward situation for Ugrasena because he loved Krishna and he respected Krishna. And therefore he wanted to serve and be intimate with Krishna. But because his position, Krishna accepted his position as superior, and there is distance with superior to a certain degree, at least it's more distant than it is with a friend or someone who is a junior. The devotees sometimes become very uncomfortable with that position, and sometimes Ugrasena would even curse himself. But when Narada comes, he sees this fabulous royalty which has been accepted by the Yadavas and Ugrasena only because it was suitable for their service to Krishna. And this is the perfect example of yukta vairagya, the most healthy state of detachment, which is one only renounces that which cannot be used for Krishna's service. That only renounces means a heck of a lot of stuff, probably most of the things we do, in one sense. A lot of the things we do, maybe not most of it. But they accept it, it's a service, and they're really only subject is Krishna out of love. They talked only about Krishna. And he, because he was their only object of worship. They're in the right position for love of God. When you love someone, they have to be in the center. What does it mean that they have to be in center? It means that their desires become your desires. That's called love. That's also happiness, actually. Their desires become your desires. Their desires become the center of your life. That's what a devotee means. And when one accepts that, the heart opens up. The heart doesn't open up in egotism. The heart opens up in that position. And the love of God, which is even coming from God, is flowing through one's heart in ecstasy. Those are the devotees whom we want to associate with. And therefore, the earth is fortunate that those devotees are now have taken birth in Dwarka. Narada is feels he's fortunate. And these devotees have no other desire. Anya bilashita shunyam, shunyam zero, anya bila. They have no other desire than to serve Krishna. And therefore their love is extended to the greatest, is extended to the greatest extent, because it basically creates a love of everything but illusion. Because what actually exists is Krishna. And when we see something separate from Krishna, mostly because of our desire to be the enjoyer and controller, when we see something separate from Krishna, it's actually not existing. The only thing that's existing is illusion. And therefore, you cannot get juice out of illusion, no more than you can get real happiness out of a dream. Anyway, and they're better than the yogis because their meditation on their object, their focus on their object of meditation is so forceful and so powerful. And therefore, the highest state of yogic meditation in Pantanjali's Yoga Sutras, when they describe the topmost yogis or who are in samadhi, their object of concentration and focus is so great that they forget themselves. This is also described between Radha and Krishna. So while do everything, they thought of Krishna, they forgot their bodies. The body is a mental conception which can be transcended. Prabhupada even gave the example of Joseph Stalin, who was so focused on spreading communism that when he underwent surgery, he did it without anesthesia because he was afraid that would risk his life. So we have this wonderful scene, and Ugrasena is being glorified. This Krishna is sitting before his throne for order. He wants an order as a servant. Krishna loves him and respects him as the king. And therefore, he wants an order to serve him. And even the Supreme Lord, who's the controller and maintainer of everything, involved in devotion, feels that the king is his meditator. So so after this glorification, we're in the part of Narada's, the Yadavas, defending themselves from what? They're defending themselves from the glorification of Narada, and they're defending their consciousness. I remember when the devotees from the Soviet Union first came to India, and what a feeling that must have been. They were persecuted, they were thrown in prisons, they were tortured, and there was the Iron Curtain. So they could never, never get out of the country to go to Vrindavan. And then they arrived in Vrindavan, and they arrived in India, and they were in ecstasy. Even just by the weather, what to speak of the spiritual atmosphere where the worship of God is so rich. I remember I was taking one of the main Russian devotees who was thrown in prison and tortured so many ways, and I was taking him on Pritham around Vrindavan at a time where Vrindavan was like Vrindavan. And we'd see a peacock every 10, 15 yards. And after the 10th peacock, seeing the plumes, the beauty, the design of the peacock in a kind of like spiritually angry mood, talking about the communists, he said, how can they deny God? And I remember when they came here, we all gave them so much praise and worship and respect. And then this same person who was in prison looked at me and said, we put him up in the gurukul next to me, and we were, you know, taking care of him so nicely. He looked at me and he said, I think that it is more difficult here than even in the prison. He said, because in the prison, all they can do is kill your body. But here, with this praise, they can kill your soul. And then his brother came by, who was even heavier than him, and interjected his opinion. And he said, Queen Kunti was right. Vipatasha, let these calamities happen again and again. So the devotee feels that way. His taste, his attraction, in his or her consciousness, is service. In devotional yoga, rather than eradicate the mind, you imbue the mind with some scars of devotion, almost as if the mind takes the shape of the soul, takes the mood of the soul to serve. So this attraction for God, it's very, very profound. It's very, very deep. And that attraction for God and the attraction to serve God is greater than anything else, even one's own life. That's why Prahlad Maharaj, when he was threatened in so many ways by his father, give up devotion, he wouldn't. Because he felt that it was a greater pain to give up devotion than anything his father can do for him. So they're deflecting the praise, but they have to accept it also because it's the words of Narada. And the way they accept it, and I spoke about this last time, it's so instructive for the devotee, that whatever qualities that we have, we should understand and then feel, but first understand Buddha Bhava, that Krishna is the cause. We're the instrument. So the qualities that we have and the utilization of those qualities. The qualities are God's. They're not ours. They can be taken away. And therefore, nasate vidyate bhavo nabhavo vidyate. That which is temporary has no existence. So, if one has a slight trace of a touch with Krishna, is there anything one cannot achieve? Krishna is boundless reservoir of mercy and one's unconditional best friend. So in the same mood, they're there saying that if we have anything, it's Krishna's mercy. And it's more a glorification of Krishna than it is us. And it's a glorification of his love, his nidapati, his unconditional love. Mercy means love, because if it's true mercy, it's given without your qualification. It's given beyond your ability to, it's not caused by you. It's coming out of the heart of compassion. And it's a high degree. It's unmotivated. Because as soon as, if someone gives you something, if they have any personal desire, it's no longer mercy. So now, the Yadavas take this advantage of Narada's glorification of them to glorify Krishna, because that's all they're interested in, out of love. Mahamahima patobi smito matro kilartida dinanataika sharanam dinarta dika sarika. He is the ocean of all greatness. Simply remembering him assures all success. He is the master and the only shelter of the most fallen, the provider of everything desirable, of those who have nothing to possess. Commentary, Krishna is not satisfied with merely fulfilling the ambitions of his devotees. He likes to bestow on his devotees more than they ever desire. So that's real love. You give more than the person even wants. Then they really become overwhelmed with your mercy. Not only do you get what you want, but they give you more than you want. Just like somebody was telling me that, you know, they got married, and naturally, and you know, you get gifts. So there was one relative that they thought they were estranged from. Not scared, it was a little bit estranged. And they opened up the gift, and it was 10 times more than they thought they would get. So that really has an effect. Intelligent person should take shelter of this great quality of his, which is like a vast ocean, deep and certain. Krishna's mercy need not take long to achieve, and it pays little regard to the qualifications of those who receive it. Yeah, I remember Srila Prabhupada's godbrother, Srila Sridhar Dev Goswami. He made a very beautiful point that the worst hypocrisy is to see another person get mercy and feel, well, that person doesn't deserve it. it's hypocrisy because we're praying for mercy all the time. We want, we expect mercy, something that we didn't deserve. We're begging for mercy. That's the whole practice of bhakti. But that should rather give us encouragement that that mercy can also come to us. As Narada says, as soon as one remembers Krishna, one's success is guaranteed, regardless of the purpose of one's endeavor. Because success is bhakti. And therefore, success is in all our hands. If success was material, then, which means to enjoy and control, then we can never be satisfied, because that type of success is based on superiority, which we can never fully have. No matter where we go, they're superior up until God. Even if one's intentions are off target, when one becomes absorbed in remembering Krishna, Krishna reciprocates by helping one adjust those intentions. I know there's one verse, I read it someplace, or one commentary. It says, if one approaches Krishna for his needs, he said, that foolish person, I will satisfy those needs. I think he said, but that's all they'll get. But here's another conception. They'll satisfy those needs in a way that will expose the futility of that objective. It's like a child wants something, and he's so desirous of it that the parent knows that that's not actually going to make the child happy, because there's such a disparity between our temporary and lasting pleasure. Lasting pleasure I'll call happiness. Temporary pleasure I'll just call pleasure. It's a dichotomy. Many of the things we're attached to that will fulfill and satisfy a particular desire are unhealthy and degrade the mind to a lower platform of perception and happiness. Perception is happiness, because if you really see what's there, you'll see God and you'll see a relationship with God. And a teacher is one who works through a person's frame of reference to increase their perception. Considering this, oh wait. In particular, and there's so many stories where Krishna will give someone something, but give them in a way that they become detached to it, just like Narada. He gave them the Dhruva Loka, a platform greater than even his grandfather, Lord Brahma. But he gave it to him in such a way that he can compare it to God's mercy and the love in his heart that he felt from being a recipient of that mercy. And he said, I realize now that what you can give me in terms of love and devotion is like a diamond. And what you can give me in terms of material things, even the greatest material things, in comparison, are like broken glass. A person who has knowledge samskaras, he understands this clearly. He understands that that happiness lies within the mode of the mind coming to sattva and transcending that altogether and abiding in the soul. And he's convinced of that. And therefore, that's the main motivating force in that person's consciousness. A person in ignorance has the arrow of Cupid in his heart, and despite so much experience and seeing what, you know, seeing the world, they're convinced that a particular temporary romantic relationship will give one eternal happiness, or a position will give one eternal happiness, or some aggrandizement or some fame will give one. But a person, that's why we're reading these scriptures, to increase these knowledge-giving samskaras, so they can rule the attachments that are unhealthy, and although giving us temporary pleasure, degrade the mind to states of anxiety and depression. Helpless persons hoping against hope to be able to surrender to Krishna can be confident of receiving his mercy even if they have no pious credits, philosophical knowledge, or devotional accomplishments. Considering this, the yadavas present themselves as most fallen and unqualified and thus fit to be favored by Krishna. But so many other fallen souls can equally gain Krishna's favor, the yadavas further tell Narada. Our position is nothing unique. You're singling us out for praise. It's just clever word. Jugglery. So, the qualities they have, they see as God's mercy. Now, this is great. This is, you know, we're really going to get into the good stuff now. We're really going to get into Krishna's pastimes. So. Kintasmat sudarap sriman paramanu grahaspadam yaradendra seyo mantri shisho vritya priyo mahan. But among us, blessed Uddhava, has received Krishna's greatest mercy. That exalted soul is Lord Yadavendra's advisor, his disciple, his servant, and his extremely dear friend. So now we have another shift, and this is, we're going to go to Uddhava. And now we're at the tenth ultimate position outside of Braj. Uddhava is the topmost devotee outside of Braj. Because he's a Parishad, he serves Krishna in love, but Parishad is a courier or a trusted servant that the master takes into confidence as a very close friend. So this is great. We're on, and because he was at that height, Uddhava was entrusted to go to Vrindavan to deliver the heart of Krishna to the gopis in the form of a very intimate message expressing Krishna's love for them. So it's very interesting here. It's going to mention in the purport. They're in a quandary, the Yadus and Ugrasena, because they don't want to deny what Narada has said about them and belie not only Narada's judgment, but belie Krishna's, the glory of Krishna's mercy. But at the same time, it's very painful for them to accept that glorification. And therefore, what they do is minimize those glories by showing a better devotee. And this has been gone on throughout the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. None of the Yadus can be as intimate as Uddhava. And they're going to explain why. Sometimes the Lord abandons us to go on a journey. This gives us such distress that even when we see him again, the pain does not go away. This is it. This is the existential pure condition of the heart. There's love for God. There's love for Krishna. And the separation, which is a symptom of that love, is unbearable. He cannot be sure when he might go somewhere else. But Uddhava is always by his side, serving Krishna, his master, and residing with him. So he has this intimate relationship with Krishna. Sometimes the Lord, the personality of Godhead, sends Uddhava on missions on which the Lord himself should go. For example, the Lord sent him to gain the release of Sambha, whom the Kauravas had taken captive. So he has the association of Krishna and the confidence of Krishna, and Krishna gives him these wonderful missions. The purport is beautiful. He discusses the mission here where Sambha, Krishna's son, tried to elope with Duryodhana's daughter, and the army headed by Bhishma and Duryodhana captured Sambha. And Uddhava was instrumental in that release. But he's not mentioning the real intimacy that Krishna's separation from the gopis gives Uddhava this wonderful message, because it's in Dwarka and it's too open. You can't share things that are intimate with those who don't have the frame of reference to understand them. And I was talking to someone about kirtan in this regard. I'm writing an article, Why Kirtan Gives the Most Bliss, and I'm going to talk about shared bliss. Not only shared bliss, shared bliss. So, to share bliss, everyone has to be feeling the same bliss, the same ecstasy, and that really creates a wonderful mood. So I was talking about in communication, the happiness of the audience will not be maximized, either listening to a kirtan or hearing a lecture, if there are some in the audience who don't have a frame of reference for the experience that you're giving them. And I saw this clearly. I saw this kirtan, and it was done. It was so classical. It was so sweet. It was done at a college, and I had gone. It was so sweet. It was so classical. And then at the end, it naturally broke into some kind of dance. And the ecstasy just increased. And the reason was, is because everyone had bought into the concept, the experience. So, you know, so the kirtaniers were able to open their hearts more and more. I saw the same kirtan group a few days later where it was a different audience. Now the people are a little bit more elderly. And instead of doing the kind of the passion of kirtan and the dance of kirtan at the end, they kind of broke into it in the middle. So they had this thing where 3/4 of the audience was dancing wildly, and 1/4 of the audience was just standing around observing. And I just realized, they just couldn't bring the kirtan to the same level of experience. And the reason they couldn't bring me, I felt, is because everyone was not on board. Everyone was not on board. So you can't share something unless everyone's on board. Otherwise, the heart has to be closed. It's just like Ramananda Roy and Lord Chaitanya. when they met, there was such intimacy. But when they looked around and they saw the other people observing it, they said, okay, we'll meet at a secret place later. They weren't gonna, they couldn't express their emotion. Or a kirtan, when you know, some impersonalist was there or some relative was there in Sri Vasanga, all of a sudden Lord Chaitanya stopped. You do not express your realizations or your emotions unless an audience has a frame of reference to understand it. And even if 75% do, a good communicator will feel his message being misunderstood, and it will stop his spontaneity or make him adjust to accommodate those people. Same thing with kirtan. According to the audience, one has to do kirtan. I mean, you can go on Nagar Sankirtan, but even then, I remember different experiences of doing that. I remember when we were in New Jersey and we had Bhima Karma, Mahamuni, Vajkishore, just a few of us went out. It was so tight, it was so representative that we felt so confident in hearts that we're communicating a positive experience and image. That it was a wonderful thing. Go a few days later and there was a bigger kirtan with, I don't know, people going down the streets like airplanes and smiling from ear to ear to express their ecstasy to others. And when people start feeling that they're not actually, people are not seeing us as, you know, and then it can affect the openings of the heart. So naturally here, Narada is going to avoid mentioning something too confidential. Not Narada, actually. It's the Yadavas are going to not mention that because it's Dwarka. They have a different conception of Krishna. It's just like if it's a family gathering, it's very inappropriate for someone to explain the romantic feelings of the elders when they were younger or something, or, you know, or for them to express that, you know, in front of others. If it's not suitable for their frame of reference and their relationship. Uddhava enjoyed Krishna's association constantly. When sent out to either rescue or console the Lord's dear devotees, Uddhava felt more satisfaction than by staying with Krishna, because association with God is consciousness or service. You're in the presence of God without the mood of service. Naham prakashya sarva sya yoga miser. I am not manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. I'm covered by my potency. You can't see God. And when you go to serve God, even if you're not staying with God, the devotion will bring you closer in heart to God. That's the whole meaning of Braj. That's why there's separation. In separation, devotees are closer to God. Because he's there in a sense. That's the message that Uddhava gives to the gopis. I am there in my Baba manifestation. Uddhava stays alone with Krishna when the Lord playfully enjoys his meal. So he's the only person who can always obtain the Lord's Mahaprasad remnants. So Prabhupada used to eat alone, just a servant. I remember in 76, Prabhupada's Maha plate in the morning with the chewed up orange and the chewed up pomegranate. He used to come up to us, about 12 people in the Gurukul. He used to come up to us. So the remnants, the Mahaprasad, the remnants from the Lord, the remnants from the devotees, called mercy. With great pleasure, Uddhava massages his master's feet and then happily falls asleep with the Lord's feet on his lap. So much pleasure, the intimacy. I remember one time I walked in to visit Tamal Krishnamurti at his house, and practically Carl and Tamal Krishnamurti are on the same bed. He enjoyed the intimate relationship. So the intimacy, it's more of the opening of the hearts. With great pleasure, Uddhava massages mass and then happily falls asleep with the Lord's feet on his lap. When the Lord goes out for confidential pleasures, Uddhava sometimes goes with him. And when Uddhava serves as the Lord's minister in this assembly hall, his precious gems of advice and his flood of witty and charming comments earn abundant praise from Sri Hari. They also delight all of us and fulfill our desires. When Krishna visited Kubja, Uddhava accompanied him. So he's so intimate and he's so competent. What an expression of love, devotion, and competency. In the spiritual world, they go along. Devotion manifests into competency. You love Krishna, you cook for Krishna, then you become a competent cook. Devotion or love is the greatest teacher. That's why the mother, who's the best mother, is not the one who has the highest degrees in child education, but the one who loves the child the most. Love teaches. That's why it's described when one has bhakti, he can run with his eyes closed and not slip. The eyes are the shruti and the smriti. When he has devotion, it's already success. Because whatever the purpose of the rules keep us fixed in devotion. When one is fixed in devotion, not that he does sinful activities, but he doesn't have to do the activities by the rules or under the rules. Savitri Bhattacharya gave an example discussing Raghunuga Bhakti in a previous class. Nice an example of an aeroplane. It's at a different plane. It doesn't have to follow the stop signs and the road regulations. It's at a different plane. So devotion is like that. And just the cowherd boys, when they're singing, it's described that it's full of love, but it's appropriate. They know how to do it in the proper way for the pleasure of Krishna. Not you don't follow the rules, especially in the devotional shastra, but when you have devotion, your impetus for following them is devotion. And then for his service to Krishna, he has what a servant. You can imagine how much Krishna appreciates him. He has gems of advice and a flood of witty and charming comments. What can be said of his continuous good fortune? Since childhood, he has been so absorbed in the taste of serving his master's lotus feet that foolish people call him a madman. We're going to stop here now. Are there any questions?
Maharaj?
Yes.
Mahamuni, please accept my humble obeisance. Well, thanks for another really wonderful class. And looking forward to when you're coming down in about a week or so.
Yeah, yeah.
I had three distinct questions came up during the class, but I don't want to monopolize the time, so maybe I'll ask one or two or whatever, and you can let me know. We could pause and see if anybody else. But one was the last point you just brought up about how, I don't know exactly how to frame it in a simple way, but the idea is that sometimes one's ability to enter into something or experience bliss or happiness out of something depends on whether the people you're with are like-minded and the degree to which they themselves can enter into it. And I wanted to ask you, do you think, I mean, we have this very positive and very good emphasis on sharing what we've been given in our tradition. And it seems like that's always been there. And perhaps even Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada took the essence of that and made it even more kind of prominent. I'm not sure, but the idea that, you know, preaching is really the core of what we're about in some way. And sometimes I find that, so to give an example, a friend of mine told me that she was going to some kind of seminar, devotee seminar, but it was kind of meant for more experienced devotees, and that someone called them up kind of the last minute and said, oh, I'm coming and I'm bringing 20 new bhaktas. It's going to be great. And she and others were really kind of disappointed because the topics they wanted to discuss, they could no longer discuss.
And yet
the devotee, I think, was very sincere and, hey, it was all about preaching. So I'm just wondering, do you think this very praiseworthy emphasis we have often could undermine this other goal of tasting this kind, some of these kind of topics? And I don't know, how do you think we kind of balance those two things? Or,
well, you know, it's been a problem it's been a problem in ISKCON because of, you know, because they have a class on Sunday. And it's kind of like for new, you know, they want new people to come. But then you have people coming for 30 or 40 years that also want to be nourished.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that the intelligent way to do things is have different classes for different people. So I would just say, yeah, I mean, you know, truths get overextended, and then they become passions. So I don't think it's any one institution or organization that does that. I think it's just a common human frailty. And, you know, there's an emphasis on sharing. It doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done with intelligence. But obviously, it can be misused. Therefore, you know, I kind of like what Yogi was doing in the Bhakti Center or something. You know, you have lectures on one day that are appropriate for new people, and then you have courses on another day that are more suitable for people that want to learn or study something. I mean, that fries me sometimes. I mean, that's happened to me. I can't remember the next time that someone brings a new person at a particular time where I'm speaking a particular subject. Sometimes, you know, if the speaker is expert, you know, they somehow or other find out how to speak in a way that the subject matter hits at different levels to different people, and it's interesting. But there's definitely, you know, different programs for different people. It has to be that way. Otherwise, people don't get nourished.
And also, new people just get freaked out unless the speaker is really qualified, it seems. Maybe not just get, but often get, or maybe get.
Well, they definitely can get. You know, they definitely can get. I mean, someone told me of an example, you know, that, you know, okay, they were giving a Sunday feast, you know. And, of course, people bring new people. So, they, and he had the class, someone just opens the book anywhere, and then they were going to comment on it. And it just opened up to a section that would offend the sentiments of the people that were coming. you know, because they didn't have the frame of reference or context to understand it. So that's always a challenge, yeah. I can't say, I mean, obviously, whatever is the emphasis can be misused, you know. So if it's preaching, it can be misused. If it's like, you know, an order of monastics, you know, that can be misused. You know, anything has a passion. So, I mean, my answer to that would be is, of course, you know. Of course, because we emphasize preaching, it's going to be misused. But I don't know if that's better than not emphasizing it, because then it won't be done. And I think it's the same thing in not a monastic order, you know, like an order of charity, you know, or, you know, it's just the nature of institutions, people, to not start with some bundagan, not start with the balance of one truth to another truth, you know, but certainly... You know, yeah, it can be misused, but not by intelligent people.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Shall I bring up the others? Do you want me to hold on for a little bit? Or?
No, bring. No, go ahead.
Another one was, the second one was, you were talking about, and I thought it was a very powerful point that you were making in relation to the Yadavas, that they were always conscious of the fact that their greatness flowed from God. And in some way, they could recognize the qualities, but without taking a kind of selfish possession of them. And they'd see themselves as instruments or something like that. And it seems to me that, and I've said to you both in privately and probably in discussions here, that I've really been, my understanding of the practice of karma yoga in the Gita has been incredibly influenced by Sri Ramanuja's explanation of it. And he says that to do karma yoga properly, one of the things you have to do is meditate on this truth and somehow find some way for this truth to affect your sense of self as you act in the world. And I don't know, do you think, I mean, how do you see that? And again, different acharyas recommend different kinds of practices. My experience is I do try to do this, and it's hard to remember for long stretches, because maybe my sankskaras are not as deep on this. But do you see this as a kind of sadhana that we could do, or do you see it more as a kind of thing that we can appeal
to? How is this connected with the other thing I said?
Oh, because the idea is that in karma yoga, when you're acting in the world, you always see that you're dependent on God, and that your ability to act, your ability to execute.
So what I was saying, if you have good qualities, right? If you have good qualities, right, you can meditate on them, you know? Rather than get absorbed in them, you can have a philosophical outlook. So you're saying, can this be generalized, you know, even to a greater extent?
Can it be generalized, and do you see it as kind of a sadhana in itself that we do, or do you see it as something we just appeal to maybe when we go over the edge in egoism or something, or we forget something? Or do you see it as a kind of sadhana?
This is kind of on a little bit, gyan applied to karma, you know? And gyan is always difficult. I mean, you know, it doesn't mean it shouldn't be applied, but it's kind of philosophical analysis, which the practical manifestation is to be detached from that which you understand is non-godly. And, you know, that which you understand is non-godly. Of course it should be applied. It can be helpful. You know, in the Yoga Sutras, programming is mentioned, how you deal with the mind. You have to counteract negative thoughts. You have to counteract the thoughts that are against, the moral restraints and moral observances that are necessary for one's consciousness to become increasingly purified and detached. But, yeah, Yeah, I think it could be spoke of more. It can be, you know, people always ask these questions. You know, they become discouraged. How can we be Krishna conscious in the world? But it just proceeds from hearing regularly. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. So I just think the lack of community with qualified speakers and an access to them regularly, which is not just an institutional problem, it's more like a social structure problem. I mean, the Prabhupada's push towards Varnashram, which meant to be more like a rural community, was to kind of create this atmosphere where people could be more naturally Krishna conscious in the world. So although the, you know, the analysis part is very important, the environment part is important too. You know, so we, you know, somehow or other, I think each, like, if, for example, yourself, right now you've got this professorship, right? So now, you know, maybe you can get into a better school, right? You know, if you applied your intelligence to it, you know, and wrote things and then got published, you can go to a better school, right? But then you have to make decisions as a spiritualist, right, about environment. You know, is that type of life and that type of thing going to create a better environment for me? You know, maybe then the small town where I am in, you know, where I can have some roots and develop organization. So I think when you have this knowledge, it has to be applied both practically to day-to-day analysis and life decisions. And that's what my lecture is about today, environment on consciousness. Parnell, New York, 4 o'clock. The ladies did such a good job organizing this. I mean, that people are coming from different places, and it's great. But, yeah, definitely. But I don't discount the, you know, the environment. You know, making big decisions. Yeah.
No, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And thank you.
Even in talking with you, you know, you understand the spiritual principles, and you're thinking like that. That's why I mentioned it. Now that you have this job, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're not just going to go for career. You know, it's just, you know, you have to look at how things impact you. Okay, what's the next question?
Thank you. The third one is, you had mentioned that that quote from the Gita, Nashato Vidite Bhavo Nabhavo Vidite Satam, that there's two ways to translate it, but normally we translate it as, you know, that which is temporary is not real, and that which is real, you know, is not beset by time.
Yeah.
Prabhupada also had said, he said on a number of occasions, that the world is real but temporary. So I was wondering if, do you think that, and by the way, I don't mind, you know, if there was differences here in some way, it doesn't hurt my faith because the Gita can be read in various ways, but do you see them as being saying the same exact thing, or do you think they're kind of focusing on different kind of aspects of a deeper truth? Because sometimes, you know, as I've said to you before, increasingly I worry about our, I think, quick way of saying the world's unreal. Sometimes it seems to me to be either wrong or impious or just bad for sadhana.
Yeah, well I think Nasate Vidite Bhavo Nabhavo is really a philosophical point, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the philosophical point is things that are changing give a false conception of identity.
Okay.
There's something that exists, but not what you think it is. Basically, that's it, you know. And that's what Prabhupada said. It's not that the world is not real, right? It's just the illusion is what you think it is. It's not that there's something there, but you're thinking it's something else. And like, for example, the body. You know, it's not that. It's not that there's not elements there, but it's not a person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that there's not elements in the body, but the conception of what it's formed is an illusion. Now, that's on the highest philosophical platform. Now the question is, now how do you deal with it when you're in this conception, right? Do you look at your kid and say, well, you're just matter like everyone else, you know? You know what I'm saying? On a philosophical platform, you know what I'm saying? If you analyze it according to Sankhya or something, right?
I don't entirely understand. Were you saying that the idea is that when we see another person in this world, like a worldly speaking person, who's kind of constructed out of Prakriti and Purusha mixed up together, that there's something which isn't real because what? Because that construction of Prakriti is not really them. I'm just trying to understand your example here that we're using as an illustration.
It's just material elements. It's just chemicals.
But there's a self there experiencing through that.
The self is real. Okay, there's a self experiencing through that. So the self is real. When you look at the body, the self is it's nasate vidyate bhavo, nabhavo, and that which is permanent is real. What's real is what's permanent. So what's real? The elements are permanent. That's real. The soul is permanent. That's real. Identification in a particular gender, family, it's an imposition of the mind. It doesn't actually exist. Would you agree with that, Mr. Salah?
Well, I would say, well, I guess. I mean, it seems to me that I'm trying to locate where the illusion, where the falsity is, and it seems to me the falsity is projecting this situation as somehow one's most fundamental situation. That's the illusion.
That's one of the illusions. That's one of the illusions. The other illusion is that, you know, what you perceive, that body is just elements and it's temporary. You know?
Yeah, but again, but who's not doing that? Like, in other words, if I see someone walking down the street, I say, yeah, there's a human being who's going to die at some point, and that human being is a product of the confluence of Purusha and Prakriti. So in that, where's the illusion?
Where's the illusion?
Yeah, in that experience. Unless, I, you know,
well,
maybe
the illusion is identifying that body as the self.
Okay, so the degree to which you don't appreciate that the real self is somehow only partially being, you know, flows through that kind of...
Well, I'm just saying, someone may experience the soul. I'm talking about the body.
Okay.
You know? It's external. It's not the self. It's changing, you know. And because it's changing, I mean, it's an impermanent thing. It's material elements just moving around. That's what the body is. It's just, I'm not projecting, you know, that you don't relate with people based on that either. But I'm talking from a purely philosophical standpoint. Then when you have that philosophical knowledge, right, then you can apply it in the appropriate way.
Obstinate. I just don't always know if I'm totally understand. And I think that doing philosophy has made me hate Advaitavada even more. And I think that it's kind of sometimes, I feel like we sometimes presuppose weird Advaita thoughts, and I don't think you are exactly, but I'm still trying to figure out, it's an illusion. So I'm standing on Ek Chakra's porch right now, and I'm looking at a car. It's a red Honda Accord, and I'm seeing it as a red Honda Accord. Is that an illusion? Is that an illusion, seeing that? Or is it more like, I'm asking you honestly, like, is it an illusion? Or maybe we're saying it is an illusion because I'm not appreciating the ultimate reality, which is that this is ultimately resting on God's energies or something like that.
Okay, that's interesting.
I'm just asking you. We could take it offline, Marge. I feel like I'm being obstinate, but
okay. Is that an illusion to see it as a car? Well, I don't think it's an illusion to see someone as, in one sense, it's not an illusion to see someone as a gender or a you know, see someone as a gender or a nationality. I guess the illusion would be is if there's a person in the car and then somehow you identify the two. Anyway, it's a good thought. We can think of it and talk about it.
Yeah, well, we'll take it offline. Yeah, well, thanks for your time, okay. Marsh. I appreciate it.
Okay. Okay, anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj.
Hi, Krishna.
Yeah, I just wanted to just quickly add that, you know, to Mahamuni's last thing there, wouldn't the
What's
illusion,
that?
I say, I just wanted to quickly
yeah.
add to Mahamuni's thing, that wouldn't the
yeah.
illusion be that, well, the that the red car is a permanent formation of the elements. The elements of the red car, of the red Honda Accord, that's real, but the conception that those elements will take that formation eternally, you know, wouldn't that be the illusion?
Well,
and the same as the person who's
not on, and what's that? What's the illusion? Okay. I'll tell you what, we'll start with this the next time so we can all think about it more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Hare Krishna, Nanda Dulo. Hare Krishna, nice to hear from you. Anybody else? Okay. Anyway, we could continue this discussion the next time. Once you call up to the Shakra Sindhu, the image will put you down.